Welcome to Emotional Sobriety, the next step in recovery with Dr. Alan Berger and Tom Rutledge. We're welcoming Carol Carter, one of our favorite guests, back to the show. And we're trying out a new format. We're going to be dividing each episode into threes. We're going to be doing nutshell wisdom for the week. We're going to be doing a topic of the day and then a tip of the day. Anything new about emotional sobriety that's testing us. So I thought we'd start with one of Tom's nutshells. One of the basic tenets of emotional sobriety is to learn how to not take things personally. Let that include whatever your should monster has to say.
If I wasn't so nuts, I wouldn't be as inspired as I am.
The nut needs the nutshell.
Truly, the thing is, when I look at across time, because I've been doing these since 1989, some of these things I look back at, and I'm going back through for some of the work we're doing, they hit me in a different place, a different way now than they did then, because I'm a different person. But some of them, I can honestly say, I've never really understood them very deeply until now. It's like, you ever get that where you write something and later you kind of go like, huh, that's actually good. You know? We know that part of our practice of emotional sobriety is being open and fair and kind and compassionate to other people. It does not work if we do it with a double standard and we don't apply the same principles to ourselves. The compassion for others includes us. We are not outside that circle. That's what you and I end up calling negative arrogance.
Melanie last week was talking about, you know, this tenet of emotional sobriety and learning how to not take things personally, and about how that can be one of the steepest hills to climb, just in terms of like getting our head around it.
Now, before we leave this section, I wrote one. I think I sent it to you guys, but I wrote one yesterday that I personally like. I'm going to read that one too. It says, once you are rid of your faults, you can spend your time pointing out faults of others.
My mom's always quoting Jesus there. It's about let he who is without sin cast the first stone. Always says that. Yeah.
Yep. What was great about that nutshell, Tom, is mm-hmm. that you extend it, not taking it personally, to the should monster.
Yeah.
And a lot of people wouldn't do that. Just like I remember this one fellow, Herb Kagan, shared about this. This one fellow in his workshop said, God, you know, I take a lot of things personally. He says, I even take reality personally. I mean, it goes to that extent. And see, we got to understand that once that dynamic is operating in us, it will attach itself to anything. We'll take anything personally. We'll take an election personally. We'll take how somebody's driving personally. We'll take the mail's not coming quick enough for us personally. I mean, it's when we step outside of ourselves, and this is one of the things I loved about Kempler's work, my mentor for many, many years. He says, when you step outside of yourself and really take a look at what you're doing, you realize how absurd and outrageous you really are. You call it the negative arrogance, but it's like we take so many things personally and we have so many claims and demands about life. It's outrageous. If you see it, like when I've seen it sometimes, I can laugh at it. I can say, oh boy.
Oh, yeah. I tell you what, I don't think we can talk about what it means to not take things personally enough, because that simple idea is very misunderstood and very easy to misunderstand. I was talking to somebody yesterday that they clearly were defining taking things personally about, they were saying like, no, I was telling them they're supposed to like it. It's like, no. It's like you don't like it. It goes back to the thing we've been working on more than anything, acceptance. You approach things that we don't have control of with indifference. I always say it's just like the weather has toward us. It's like it's not a negative thing. It just means I know that I can't control that. So I'm not going to put any energy into it.
I had a great opportunity to not take something personally a few days ago. And of course I took it personally and ran with it. But what I love about the experience was someone took a real good narcissistic swing at me. And I saw something new in my behavior this time. I knew exactly what to do with that. create a distance. This isn't somebody that's been involved in my life at all in over 20 years and just thought they'd pop up and throw a punch. And so I was able to put that where it belonged. But as with skilled narcissists, they knew kind of where to hit. And so I took that and continued to hit myself with it for a few days until I could see what I was doing and then let it go. But you cannot take, whether it's your committee or what others are saying to you personally, if you want any peace of mind at all in your life. And so this was sort of a graduation experience as far as quickly understanding how to navigate the distance part.
Love it.
But I still have a little bit of work to do in releasing it sooner than I did. But when I did was still worlds better than I have done before. So I'm grateful for the opportunity to keep learning and growing.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're beautiful.
What you did with that, Carol, I think it is really deserving of being underscored because, see, when there's a part of me that agrees with what the person's saying,
yes,
I'm vulnerable to, yes, their behavior. If there wasn't a part of me in agreement, it would be so much easier to just, I'd be tested.
Totally.
It rolls off my back.
Yes.
But the thing, and see, there is an opportunity in it. That's the, what I wanted to really emphasize with what you're saying. See, opportunity, if I am taking it personally, to ask myself, what part of me is agreeing with what they just said?
I actually did.
See, you did. I'm underscoring it because that's a way of unraveling this. Because,
yes,
see, you know, more than anything, you know, we're never going to be in a place where we're unshakable, meaning life,
right,
is going to happen. Shit's going to happen. Should monsters happen? I mean, all that, mm-hmm, stuff is there. What we're learning with emotional sobriety, what I'm learning is it's how I deal with that experience. And so when I take my disturbance of somebody saying something to me that I take personally, I can use that as the beginning of a process of dealing with something inside of me that needs to,
right,
be
dealt with. Right, right, right.
And that's the beauty of this, is,
yes,
that you don't have to, right? We can use any experience we have to grow us and to nourish us, especially the ones that are painful and disturbing.
If somebody insults me about something that I don't get, that's true about me, but that I don't give a shit about, it's like, I'm not offended. You know, if somebody says, you're one of the most disorganized human beings I've ever seen, I go like,
guilty as charged.
Yeah.
Somebody says, hey, you're selfish. I can say, you're right. Sometimes I'm selfish.
Yeah, I had that with my girlfriend last week, is that she was very disappointed in some things that were happening in the relationship. And then once I cleaned up as much as I could clean up, that disappointment persisted. And that was where I had to really get in there and kind of decouple myself in terms of not taking it personally, because past the point where, you know, I've exerted as much control and done everything I could and kind of tried to meet her where she was at, the rest was up to her. And, you know, because I really want to make her happy as much as I can, I hate disappointing the people closest to me. Yeah, that's a tough pill to swallow.
Recovering from the conditional is what I call it. Like, in other words, because if you have kept on, you wouldn't have thought about it that way originally, but it would be like, as soon as she is feels better about me, I'll be okay. Even if she doesn't feel better about me, I'm okay. And if I'm not, then I need to work on that.
I got some work to do. That's right, yeah. To get okay.
Yeah, totally. I'm still very much, yeah, there's some conditional attachments I have.
Yeah. Oh, we all do, sure. Yeah.
It's a constant continuing to try to be aware of these things.
That's right. It's a great little segment, Patrick. What's next?
Changes. Well, as a nod to my namesake, David Bowie, we're going to be talking Changes for our main topic today. And change is the tune we dance to, as Al Swearengen once said. And how does emotional sobriety, or how can it show up as the ground shifts beneath our feet?
You know, it's been public information, the stuff I've gone through this last couple of years in terms of lots of changes in my life, a lot of pain and disappointment and disillusionment and all that stuff, right? You know, when I was dealing with the divorce, I was listening to this podcast of these two women authors that had been betrayed by their partners, both very successful writers. And they were doing a podcast on trying to find a silver lining in betrayal. That's what the name of their podcast was.
I like it.
And it just was wonderful to listen to these two very, very well-spoken and great authors talking about their experience. And first of all, how courageous it was, right, for them to expose themselves on this public radio station about their experience they had and the pain that they experienced. And they both came to one conclusion that stood out to me as such an interesting thing that for me is one way I don't stay connected to change. And I'll talk more about that. But what they said they do is the big mistake they made in their life is they took today, they highlighted it, copied it, and then pasted it in tomorrow. Copied all the words, what it was, what was happening, put it in tomorrow as though there's nothing going to change from today to tomorrow. I'm going to keep living. My husband's going to still love me. My family's going to be the same. Nothing's going to change until all of a sudden you wake up and you realize, wait a minute, I've been in a trance. Is this crazy? I'm sitting here thinking that things don't change when the only thing that's true, the only thing permanent is change. Change is occurring all the time for us. But there's something in us that wants to hold on to now forever instead of flowing with it. And I think it goes down to the heart of this emotional sobriety issue. We do not have confidence and be able to deal with what's next in our life. So when we don't, when my self-confidence, and I'm talking about, you know, we understand self-esteem is composed of both self-confidence, right? Feeling my ability to cope with life on life's terms, that's the self-confidence, as well as self-worth, right? I feel worthy of love and success. They're combined and that creates self-esteem. But if I don't have faith in myself to cope with life, then what am I going to do? When something good happens, I'm going to do what? Want to hold on to it, not let it go. Because I'm afraid it won't happen again. I don't have the ability to recreate something good. All of a sudden, it's almost like I believe that this happened by chance. And then, my God, if it slips out of my hands now, I'll never have it again. See, something like that is what we're doing at some unconscious level. And it gets us to hold on so tightly to now. When I'm holding on to now, I really am. I'm rigidifying my experience in life. I am paralyzing myself in another way to think about it, because
you're not being in the now.
Yes.
I'm not being in the now and the next. See, I love how Gestalt therapists have talked about this. There's no such thing as now, because now always moves to next. It does.
Right now, my
first word goes to my second word, right? This moment, this second goes to that second, to that second, to that second. What happens is that when I don't have confidence, I don't trust going to next.
Yeah.
I don't trust it.
We tend to take confidence and make it very specific. We don't. Yeah. What you're talking about is what I call a bit broader general confidence. In other words, I can handle whatever comes my way. But the way we think about confidence is we think there's, you know, the little should monster in there goes like, you need to be able to predict what's going to happen and be ready for it. It's like, I can deal, you know, and what you just said about the now to next is perfect. I had just written down, reality is constant change. It's like, here's a change. Here's number two change. Here's number three change. It's fluid.
It's a flow. You remember that book, Tom? You probably remember it. Don't push the river. It flows by itself. Do you remember those two therapists that wrote it? And it was all about that, is that when I am fighting my experience or fighting reality, I'm trying to control something that's out of my control.
in hindsight, after, I mean, I'm just thinking about like some of the hardest things that you and that Alan and Tom have had to face in the last few years. I mean, dealing with betrayal, dealing with cancer, and at the outset of those calamities, I'm sure, like with any of us, the thought had to have passed your mind, I don't know if I can do this. This is like, this seems insurmountable. But I mean, I'm have you allowed yourself some reflection on the other side? Oh, wow, I did do that. Not only did I survive, but.
Yeah, the reflection's interesting, though, because I did it. But I'll tell you, I had support from Carol. She would send me stuff to help me shower because I had surgery in the middle of all of that stuff. She was very concerned. She would reach out to me with a lot of love and care. Tom, we've talked about Patrick. You've been there, supported me through this thing. Yeah, I did some of the footwork myself, man, but I can't tell you what it meant to have a community of life-affirming support. Right. And that's what we've created, a life affirming community in this emotional sobriety space.
Right. And I'll just add to anybody listening who hasn't gotten this part quite yet. That is a reflection of your strength.
Yes.
That's not weakness. It takes guts to, especially, you were just talking about feeling bad earlier, Carol. It's like, especially when you feel like shit, it's like, I don't have, you know, when we were in our stuff, we don't have any social desires to listen, get together and hang out and bullshit with people. It's like, no, sometimes it's just the hardest thing you can do is just to say, I'm going to talk to another person, or I'm going to ask for something that I need. And it's like, we do it because it's the right way to take care of yourself.
Wonder where that comes from, that not thinking that I have the capacity to do it. And I have a lot easier of a time when I'm talking to somebody else with their crisis and the fear that they're facing.
Right, because that double standard, yeah.
Right, right. It's easier for me to dig into the archives and be like, well, you know what? There was a time when I thought that I did not have the capacity to overcome the fear I had about some change that I was experiencing. And then somehow I got through it. I got to the other side and, you know, but like, yeah, I lost my train of thought because of the shit monster that hovered at the bottom.
I'm sorry. I can't control him. I'm sorry. He just pops up.
Yeah, no, I love him. But yeah, I change is something I don't think I'm capable of grappling with, but then oftentimes.
Your point, Patrick, was you said, what happened that we didn't develop that confidence?
Yeah,
right. That's the question.
Life as on life's terms. See, I listen to you, Patrick. What happens that we don't have that confidence? And look, there are many answers to that, but I think the most important thing is what you grow up with is what you learn.
Yep.
And if your parents didn't show you, didn't have this attitude, right, that they didn't have the expectations how things were supposed to be, didn't have this conditional consciousness, right? This consciousness of everything being contingent. You know, if this happens, then that'll happen for me, right? That kind of a thing. If they didn't have it, we wouldn't have grown up with it. You know, I told you guys many times that I didn't realize it at the time, but when my father died and I was with my grandfather, this was my grandfather's only son, and understandably, you know, now that I've been a therapist, I've worked with a lot of parents that have lost children. It's devastating, man. It is devastating for those parents to deal with that situation. And when I'd get in the car with my grandfather and go out to his plastic sunshade store to help him put shades together and stuff like that, he would start bawling. And what he would say over and over and over again, this shouldn't have happened,
right?
Your son is supposed to bury you. You're not supposed to bury your son. He couldn't let go of it. He could not let go. He could not face that reality that this is what happened. And now let's get on with dealing with it. He just felt so bad, had so much pain, a lot of pity, a lot of self-pity, because my dad and my grandpa were very close together, very close, right? Father and son relationship like I had with my dad, right? That's one thing that did get passed on. But he had that conditional consciousness. He had that consciousness that, you know, If this happens, then I'll be okay. If life goes like this, then I'll be fine. And look, right. that I got that. Of course I got that conditioned into me or programmed right, into right. me or taught to me. How could I not? And nobody said this is the way it is. They didn't have to say that. I just observed it.
Right.
It's what I saw. It's what I lived in.
Right. That's absolutely one of the things, because it's not, yeah. You know, in my first book, In Simple Truth, I have a chapter it says your family is your alma mater. It's where you learned how to be who you are. And it's like, and basically what we're saying here, we don't have to have villains. We're not villainizing anybody. We're just saying, you know, what did you learn about self-esteem? What'd you learn about shame? It's like my joke. It's always, I say, at your alma mater, what did they teach you about sex? Go like, oh no, we didn't have anything about sex. It wasn't even on the department of that. But it's like the idea, and what you're also talking about, Alan, with your grandfather, is because one of the things I see come up is when we start talking about the unrealistic expectations, people want to make exceptions for the huge things. But you're just that's a beautiful example. Your grandfather understandably objected to reality here, and because he saw this as something that was happening backwards, it was not the way it was supposed to be. But the truth is, his unrealistic expectation was that life is going to be predictable and fair. It's not.
And the other expectation is, these kinds of painful things shouldn't happen to me.
Right.
Somehow, that he was claiming this, what I like to think of as special status. I'm a human being, but I have an exemption here. I don't have to pay taxes this year. Right? I don't have to face difficult, painful situations. Oh, everybody else, all the other human beings need to do that. But I should be spared of the tragedies.
But they're not the main characters of the movie. I'm the main character of the movie, and the main character of the movie makes it all the way to the end, relatively unscathed. But that's the
idea. See, that's the thing that sets us up, so that when this stuff happens, nobody's taught us how to deal with disappointment. I didn't get a chance to see that. All I saw is a man that was disappointed with life, very devastated by this experience, this loss that happened. And all I saw him do was go further and further down. He got depressed. He gave up on life. He threw in the towel. He could not find a way out of that darkness.
I had a father who was beaten by disappointment. He was defeated by it.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, that's exactly right.
This reminds me of a book, probably from the 70s, by Rabbi Kushner, When Bad Things Happen to Good People.
Love it.
And one of the things he says early on is, you know, why me? And his answer is, why not? Why not me for this tragedy? Why Susie or Jane or Joe and not Carol? And we're not immune. We're just not immune.
We're not, I think we fantasize that immunity because we know we don't know how to cope. So we make up these rules and ideas as though somehow I'm protected. Like you said, Carol, I've now got exemption. Somebody's given me the exemption from all of this other stuff that's going to go on. But the real truth is, I wanted an exemption because I did not know how to deal with that.
That reminds me of one other thing. I've been following a woman who's a psychologist, and she has, and I've forgotten right now the name of the disease, but she is going deafblind. And she is remarkable. She is phenomenal. And she said, what I really don't like is when people come up and tell me how brave I am and how courageous I am and on and on. And she said, what they don't know that they're saying to me is, holy shit, I can't even imagine how I could deal with that.
That's right.
They're talking about themselves. They're not talking to her about where she is. And where she is a very strong, capable woman who is arming herself with every single tool she can muster to figure out how to still navigate her world when the lights go out and the sound goes. And she is highly motivated, and it's astonishing to watch her. But her point is well taken. And I think of how many times I've offered condolences that were less about, and I'm not accusing myself of being a horrible person, I'm not here, but were less about compassion for someone's experience, more than my horror that that could have been me.
One of the things I say this to a lot of people who basically have no idea what to do. We talk about losing a parent, but losing a child is nobody knows what to say when it comes to that. But people won't shut up. Oh, exactly. I've worked with several of those cases,
and it's like,
tell people, it's like, it's okay to tell the truth and just say, I don't know what to say. You know, I love you. You know, that's it. That's plenty. You know, instead of trying to figure out what you're supposed to say, because I promise you, when they get farther along the line of their healing, they're going home and laughing about what you say, what you tried to do to try to make you feel better. It's like, you know,
I had an opportunity to help somebody in my fellowship who went through his business failed, and it's a gym, and I don't even know how much money he sunk into it, but he's like gone deep into debt. And he's lost relationships, you know, he's kept his sobriety. But that was another case where I didn't know what to say to him about it, because it just sucks. And like, you know, that's a huge, you go way out on a limb with a business venture like that. I've never like put that much money into something and had it gone sideways. But anyway, like I just sat with him a couple times and we had some lunch. And then I helped him move the equipment. You know, which was really scary, by the way. If anybody has a gym that you know that goes out of business, just hire a guy to help with that. Don't lift the jagged pieces of metal on your own, because it sucks. Yeah. I just got like the nicest message from him, just about how much he appreciated having another guy there, just to be with him. And like, it was nothing I said, and I, you know, because I couldn't think of anything to say. But
the other thing occurs to me that you can say, and I've done this a few times, it's like just not trying to say something is good. It's like the other thing is you can just, we don't ask questions, you know, when we don't know what to do. We just I've said that to some people before. Is there anything I can say that would make a difference? You know, and usually their answer, I'm just acknowledging that situation, because mostly they're going to say, no, there's nothing. And I go, okay, I'm here to do whatever I can do to support you, and just be there. Don't run away from people in grief.
All right. I mean, I think with me and change, it's, you know, number one, disappointment is an inevitability, not in all situations, but just as kind of like a factor
across time.
Across time. And then also the disappointment is inevitable. And then also that joy that I feel that I've lost, or like that opportunity I had that went away. If I'm alive, the opportunity exists for me to recreate, you know, like we can. It doesn't need to be copy paste. You know, you can regenerate, you know, whatever that thing was that kind of gave you so much joy and purpose. If you have the benefit of time, then that you can grow again. And I just never believed that. I believed, you know, that somehow the disappointment, what was not inevitable, that I had special status, as you guys say, and that also that I did not have the capacity to plant new seeds and to have those grow into mighty trees.
One of the things I'm enjoying about age, and I don't know if it's age or just that I'm not working now and have more time and to think about other things than work, but I'm enjoying the gift of curiosity. And I'm finding so many new ways to really enjoy rich, beautiful things about life that I had not paid attention to because I was busy cutting and pasting my day. And I just want to hold out the possibility, Patrick, that there are beautiful, as yet undiscovered things ahead that are just so rich and marvelous.
I have an easier time believing that today than I did 7-8 years ago. Yeah. To close our episode, we thought we'd leave our listeners with a tip of the day. Anything new about emotional sobriety that may have greeted us?
Maybe it's not new, but it's really emerging from the discussion we had today is that, see, our relationship with having experiencing a failure or making a mistake is really a part of this whole experience of emotional sobriety. What is the healthiest relationship? What's the best way to process a failure? Something that maybe wiped you out financially, or where you invested a lot of money and it just did not unfold according to your business plan, or in a personal relationship, the relationship didn't unfold in the way you wanted to, or you make a mistake. Right. You do something and you say, God darn, you know, I think the big thing here, and you will hear this from anyone who's really successful, is that they built their success from their last failure. Now, what does that mean? It means that they were able to digest, to really unpack the failure and see what kind of mistakes they made, learned from them, and then integrated that into their behavior so that they could now meet the next experience with more maturity. Right. See, maturity is simply learning from your experience. There's no better definition of maturity.
Well, and let me add to that, because you're the one who got me, and I have it somewhere in one of my nutshells now, but you turned me on to this idea, and it'll fit right in here, which is, it is not just our right to learn from experience, it is our responsibility.
Right.
That is, you know, it is our responsibility to do that. We're coming up short for ourselves.
Yes.
If we're not learning from learning from experience, because that's how we learn. That's, you know, to not learn from experience is like not to go to class.
Yeah. And look, it's not only our right, but it's also a gift that we have. See,
yeah.
It's amazing who we are. We're really amazing in so many ways when you think of how we grow and function and how we coordinate so many things and learn. Our ability to learn is a phenomenal. It really mm-hmm. is. It's incredible. And it's easier to learn when things are objective, right? Yep. You don't take math personally. I mean, you may if you're having trouble taking it, but they're numbers. but let's say a business and you're failing, you feel like I failed. Not the business failed, I failed. You make a mistake. I'm the mistake. Not that I made a mistake. See, as soon as we identify with the experience we're having, we're in trouble. That's where trouble really comes from, because now I'm fused with it. And when I'm that fused with an experience, I can't learn from it. There has to be some separation. There has to be. And that's why this work, the intrapsychic work that Tom does, the self-parts work, which is the same thing, just different language that I do. That Carol does and stuff like that. When we get people to separate themselves from the issue, that space reveals or allows them to discover all kinds of important things.
What's the opposite of being in relationship to these things? Being possessed by these things. And if I'm possessed by my should monster or my addiction, I don't know the difference. You know, So that's the first thing we always do is get these things apart.
Yeah. Yes. Right on. Very good.
Thanks for being here, Carol.
Love you guys. Bye.